Good day, and welcome to the ninth session of Drinker Biddle's Inside the Beltway presentation. The speakers today are Fred Riche and Brad Campbell. I would now like to turn the call over to Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much, and hello, everybody. This is the ninth of our Inside the Beltway calls, and the attendance has just been fantastic, so thanks to you all for doing this. The two speakers today will be myself, and I'm chair of the ERISA Financial Services team at Drinker Biddle, which means the attorneys who work with service providers to help with their issues related to retirement plans. And, of course, we also work with plan sponsors. With me is Brad Campbell, and Brad has a similar practice. But even more importantly, Brad is the former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration. In other words, in terms of policy and enforcement, Brad has been there and done that. So we have a great chance to hear from Brad in terms of how the DOL looks at things and then to juxtapose that with the private sector view now that Brad is in the private sector. So that you know, this program is being recorded, and it'll take a few days, but we'll post it to our website after a handful of days, and it'll be posted under www.drinkerbiddle.com. So drinkerbiddle is one word, .com. And there's a tab called Resources that is a more specific location where it'll be on that website. Even more importantly, though, we're going to send you an email when it's posted, so you'll know. And if you want to re-listen to it or if you have some colleagues that want to hear it, you're certainly welcome to do that. I want to express my gratitude to Nat Tixis and Jim Dolan for having done such a great job of supporting these conference calls and allowing us to continue to do them, to continue to offer them to you all. So let me turn it over to Jim for a second. Jim?
Yes, thanks so much, Fred. Appreciate the opportunity, and we appreciate the partnership. We're excited and happy that we're able to provide access to your thought leadership. For those of you who don't know, Natixis Global Asset Management is a multi-affiliate organization with more than 20 specialized investment managers. You may be familiar with Luma Sales, Harris Associates, and the Oakmark Funds, as well as Alpha Simplex. We pride ourselves on helping our clients build more durable portfolios. We'd also like to let you know that we've recently released the results of a 401k plan participant survey. We went out and asked 1,000 participants about their mindset and retirement readiness. So if you'd like to learn more about that and more about Natixis, we'd ask you to go to durableportfolios.com. And again, Fred and Brad, thank you for doing this call. And Brad, I'll hand it over to you.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Jim, and thanks, Fred. And again, thanks to all of you for taking a little bit of time out of your day to join us. We really do appreciate it. We thought, given that we are about 6 weeks away or so from the midterm elections, that we ought to spend at least a few minutes talking about what those elections might mean for retirement policy, both in the short term and the long term, and what it might mean for plans and their sponsors. As you probably know from being unable to avoid the 24-hour news cycle, the big question in this upcoming midterm election is, will Republicans take control of the Senate and will they retain control of the House? I suppose you could phrase that question the opposite way. Will Democrats retain control of the Senate and take control of the House? There seems to be not so much belief among pundits that the House is in play, but that the Senate may well be. And so one of the questions is, what would that mean if Republicans did take over or if Democrats did stay in control of the Senate for all the issues that we're concerned about? There's a question about what they call the lame duck session, that is, the Congress that's still in place after the election but before January, so that we know who's won and lost, but the body is still as it is today. And so what do they do in that 2 or 3 months to put in effect the policies before things change, if they change? And one of the big issues in play, and there seems to be some general bipartisan agreement here, but the timing and other issues could be affected by it, is extending the funding rules for multi-employer plan. These are the Taft-Hartley jointly trusteed, what you think of as the union pension plans,
traditional pension plans. And there's a lot of issues about the funding rules and the degree of underfunding among those plans. And right now, the current rules that gave them a little bit of relief are scheduled to sunset at the end of the year. And so there's been a desire to extend those while Congress works on a more permanent funding solution. So one of the issues that could be at play, depending on who wins the election, is how long that extension period is, whether those extension period actually includes any other provisions on other topics or actually make some substantive changes to the rules. So for those of you who are involved in those kind of multi-employer plans, the election and the aftermath is something you need to pay attention to. Bigger picture, one of the big questions will be, you know, how well does Congress work within itself and how well does it work with the president? Obviously, if one party controls both houses, Congress at least will play nicer with itself, which is not something we've historically seen with a divided Congress. But, of course, they'll still have, even if Republicans were to take the Senate, you'd still have a division with the president. And the policy issues here, you know, the disagreement run pretty deep. On retirement issues, I think there was a very useful thing we saw this week, which was a hearing in the Senate Finance Committee looking at retirement issues. And one of the themes that keeps coming up is a concern, particularly among some of the Democrats, that the retirement system we have is using the tax subsidies, you know, the tax expenditures, the tax benefits for our retirement system to benefit the wealthy and less so the less well-off. And so the GAO just came out with a report this week that looking at IRA accounts, for example, that there were about 9,000 out of 43 million, but about 9,000 IRA accounts that had a balance of $5 million or more. And this seemed to be a source of real concern for some folks, particularly on the Democratic side, that this was an abusive tax shelter kind of effect. I think probably the bigger issue is looking that, you know, the vast majority, 99.9%, well, not 0.9, but 99% of those accounts had far less than a million, and in fact only, you know, several tens of thousands saved up. But there's an ongoing question as to how are we going to expand access to retirement plans and how do we fund that. And the big difference I think you'll see in policy is which had the degree to which there are new restrictions or income limitations placed on the tax benefits for these types of, whether it's IRA accounts or 401ks or, you know, the various sorts of vehicles out there, and how Congress goes about doing that, and whether those cause inadvertent harm to the system in terms of making some of these plans less viable. This is something we've been talking about for a while, the kind of risk that tax reform poses. But the outcome of this election has, I think it's fair to say, has some determining factor on exactly how much of a reduction in the tax subsidies we might see in these plans. So there's a number of issues at play, but a lot of it's going to depend, I think, on how ultimately the president and the Congress, however it's constituted, decide to work together or not. And I think, like most of us, I probably don't hold out a lot of hope that that's going to happen. Fred, what are your thoughts?
Brad, let me ask you another sort of a follow-up question. When you say you were talking about, you know, how they're going to pay for any deductions that are created by expanding the coverage of retirement plans, that suggests that, and I think it's true, but I just want to verify with you, that wording it that way suggests that whatever is done, they're going to want a balance so that there's no net increase in tax deductions, so that anything they give away to one group, they get back from another group. Did I understand that correctly?
I mean, I think that's a fair way to think about it. Now, whether they're looking for a one-to-one offset, in other words, that there be an actual parity, or, you know, whether there be greater subsidies to, you know, say, folks on the lower end, and whether it exactly balances, I don't know. But really, for both parties, in the proposals we've seen over the last couple of years, they've all included some measure of, you know, significant change. For example, the, you know, former Chairman Camp of the House Ways and Means Committee, a Republican, suggested capping for 10 years the inflation index increases on contribution amounts. So for 10 years, the amount would never go above $17,500, for example. And there was another proposal to split that $17,500 so that the first half is pre-tax, the second half is Roth only. You know, there are on both sides, there are a number of folks looking at those issues. I think in general, you're right that they're looking to find revenue to fund something at the other end. But there's also, I think, the reality that there are people looking to find revenue to fund unrelated things. I mean, the tax subsidy, the tax expenditure that they see in the retirement system is, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, we can argue that that's not even fairly assessed, since Congress looks at what happens only in the next 10 years. So all of the deferred taxation in our retirement system that's beyond 10 years is treated as lost, even though, of course, we know it's not. But it's an ongoing problem, and you know, how much of it is used to fund greater access versus how much is used for other things is a political fight we'll see down the road. For example, some of it might be used to fund, you know, corporate tax reform.
You know, and Brad, it seems like in recent years and probably continuing into the future that Congress is viewing Roth deferrals to IRAs or retirement plans as an increase in revenue because of that same 10-year window. They get to tax the money today, even though they're giving up even more by not being able to tax the deferral in the future when it's paid out, if it's more than 10 years from now. And they call that a net gain because of how they mark up things. Is that, do you think that's true, that the Roths?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Congress likes Roth. Leaving aside any policy virtues to Roth, Congress likes Roth because it results in tax revenue today instead of lost revenue in the future, as they tend to think of it. Everyone seems to, you know, I'll gladly pay you tomorrow for a hamburger today is the mantra Congress has when it comes to getting that tax revenue up front. And again, that's a feature of the way they score tax legislation that really gives a double whammy effect on our retirement system.
Yeah, yeah. You know, another issue that raises, and it almost doesn't matter if it continues in its current dysfunctional form or if Congress, if the Senate swings over to the Republicans, because you've got a Democratic president who can veto things that he doesn't like. But either way, it seems like we're down to the last 2 years of a presidency. In other words, a lame duck president. We've got a Congress that either in just the House or in both the House and the Senate are going to be held by the opposition, the Republicans. And so legislatively, not much will probably happen. And I think there are two phenomenons that could happen about that, but I don't know how that all fits in with the lame duck period for a president. So let me explain those two phenomenons and then ask you what you think about whether or not that will actually occur in a lame duck period. The first phenomenon is that my experience is, and you would know better than I, that when there's legislation in Congress that is actually moving, that it's being seriously considered, the Department of Labor defers. That is, they won't write any regulations and very little guidance in that area because they're waiting on Congress to make a change, and it would be impolite in Washington, D.C. terms for the DOL to act while Congress is considering something. So that's, but with no legislation moving, that means that the DOL has a complete free hand to be the sole problem solver, if you want to view it that way. The other is that with the administration not being able to get its agenda through Congress, the only way they can really develop as policy their agenda and then enforce it would be through the regulatory process, would be through the administrative agencies. So it seems like the dysfunctional part, the fact that Congress is dysfunctional would encourage the White House to have activist administrative agencies over the last 2 years and to get its agenda out there that way. But I don't understand the overlay of it being a lame duck period and what all that means. What do you think about what I just said?
Well, you know, in some ways what you described are two, I think, true but contradictory impulses. And I think particularly if the Republicans take the Senate so that the Congress is now more unified on its policy views, that you'll see a much more activist, not that we've seen a shy and retiring executive branch so far in terms of regulations in our area, but, you know, I think you'll continue to see a more activist administrative effect. You know, a lot of regulations being promoted and pushed through to try and get them done in the remaining, you know, 2 years of this administration. And in terms of being willing to, you know, act when Congress is considering something, I think it's likely over the rest of this administration that we'll probably see, even where the Congress might at least be making noise about something, most of those things may not go anywhere, particularly if we continue to have a divided House and Senate, with the result that I think the agencies will feel free to continue. I think the exception to that might be, for example, this multi-employer these multi-employer plan issues where, you know, there's actually bipartisan interest in doing something that's real. Just the question is, what is the something? So I think the agencies would be a little more cautious about treading in there, where they wouldn't be on other administration priorities. So long-winded answer to that is, I think we're going to continue to see a lot of aggressive regulations coming out and a lot of effort to try and finish the ones that we've already seen.
Okay, well, thank you. You know, the next topic that we're going to talk about today, and we'll have a Q&A question at the end, as the operator said, so to the extent anybody has any questions about any of these subjects, including the one we just discussed, to, you know, feel free to hold on to it and bring it up then. Next subject is going to be brokerage accounts or brokerage windows inside participant-directed plans. I'm sure that many of you all know that just a few weeks ago, the Department of Labor issued an RFI, a request for information on individual brokerage accounts inside participant-directed plans, such as 401k plans. And, you know, I think we're looking at, there's a whole series of questions, a bunch of them, and they're asking the private sector to provide information. And once the deadline come and goes in a month or two, then the DOL is going to examine all that testimony and consider whether or not they need to provide additional guidance in that area. Having said that, Brad, why don't I turn it over to you, and you can give us a little history and perhaps even some prognosis.
Well, sure. I mean, you all probably remember back in 2012 when we were getting ready to deal with the actual implementation of the participant disclosure requirements for participant-directed individual account plans, the 404A5 regulation. DOL put out some guidance that proved to be very controversial. The regulation does provide that a brokerage window is not a designated investment alternative. In other words, a brokerage window is not a core menu item about which you have to disclose a lot of performance history and so forth. The brokerage window is really a service, and so you disclose that it exists and how a participant uses it, what the costs are associated with using it, et cetera. And in this guidance DOL put out back in 2012, they suggested, though, that as an enforcement policy, the agency might want to see not only a core lineup of investments, you know, 404C-compliant DIA menu, but where there's a brokerage window, see that, and also have the plan sponsor potentially have to treat as a DIA investments that enough participants bought through the window. And that was obviously a very controversial decision because it wasn't consistent with what the regulation had said up to that date. And a lot of people said, well, you know, this is the first time we've ever heard anyone suggesting that we as a plan sponsor might have to treat the investments that people select through a brokerage window as something we had selected for them and provide that full history and so forth. And so it was a very controversial approach. And the department, in explaining why they did it, indicated that they had some real concerns about brokerage windows, particularly plan designs that were brokerage window only, where there might be one or more brokerage windows but no core menu, and that this would potentially deprive participants of the ability to make informed decisions and therefore might well be a fiduciary breach. Remember, the idea behind the 404A5 regulation, the participant disclosure regulation, is that if participants have the duty to select their investments, then there must be a fiduciary duty on the plan administrator to give them the basic information with which to make those decisions. And since a brokerage window isn't really an investment but is a service and it doesn't have all that investment-related information, DOL viewed it as, you know, something some people might be using to avoid making the required disclosures for participants. But due to the controversy, DOL did retract that guidance and replace it with the guidance we're currently operating under, which says, you know, disclose the how the window works, et cetera, but you don't have an obligation to disclose what people do on the other side of it or to treat those as designated investment alternatives. But in that reform guidance, DOL laid down a marker and said, but we're still worried about this. You know, we're still worried that people might be using this to evade disclosure. We're still worried that we don't really know what's going on with all the different uses of brokerage windows. So we're going to talk to the regulated community informally, and we may be back with something else. And this RFI that came out a short while ago is them coming back with something else. It's them asking questions to understand exactly how these things are working so that they can determine what, if any, steps to take next.
Okay, well, the You know, I think the DOL has historically said, with no equivocation, that plan fiduciaries must prudently select and monitor all service providers. Select and monitor. And as Brad just pointed out, the Department of Labor views the providers of brokerage accounts not as an investment, but as a service. And therefore, those broker-dealers are service providers, which the responsible plan fiduciaries must prudently select and monitor. That involves, as with any service provider, looking at their services, looking at their fees, and understanding their conflicts of interest. At the least, it involves that. I'm not so sure that the private sector has been, the plan fiduciaries in the private sector have been actively doing that. And but to discuss that intelligently, I think we really have to break it down to three scenarios in which brokerage accounts are used. The first, and typically a small plan scenario, is where each participant can pick their own broker-dealer and work with their own financial advisor, that it's not a broker-dealer or brokerage account with a provider that's selected by the plan fiduciaries. That is very common, for example, in medical groups, law firms, maybe accounting firms, but in typically high-paid, highly educated organizations where the partners or the senior folks have a lot of clout in how the plans are set up and run. So that's where each participant can select their own, and usually with multiple broker-dealers providing services. The second scenario is where a provider, that is the record keeper, the bundled provider, has an alliance with a broker-dealer where they're connected electronically and they offer it as a package to plans. In those cases, the fiduciaries select it. I mean, they decide whether or not to offer that option, and if they do, they offer that particular provider of a brokerage window. And usually those are, relatively low-cost brokerage accounts in terms of, say, commissions for trades. The third, then, and the one that I think people were shipping information to the DOL about, back in 2012 that got the Department of Labor concerned, of which there are only a limited number in my experience, is where the plan sponsor says to all of the participants, you're in a brokerage account. In other words, there is no core lineup. There's no group of designated investment alternatives that the fiduciaries prudently select and monitor. Each of those, I think, presents certain unique fact circumstances to the Department of Labor and also to the plan fiduciaries. For example, and Brad, I'm going to bounce it back to you to see what you think about this, but for example, where the plan sponsor says, everybody here, you're in a brokerage account and you're on your own, swim with the sharks. I think the Department of Labor there could say that a plan, either to get 404C protection or as a general fiduciary role, has to offer a core lineup of investments. I think they could actually come in and say, wait a second, or there has to be a fiduciary determination that every individual participant has a level of knowledge to invest appropriately in brokerage accounts, or fiduciary advisors have to be provided, or something. I have a hard time imagining that one is going to be left alone. The second one is where each partner can select their own, and there are multiple the broker-dealers involved. I do think the DOL could reinforce this position that it's a fiduciary decision to prudently select and monitor those broker-dealers, even if they give participants the power to suggest who the broker-dealers should be, which then means the burden on the fiduciaries is increased over what is commonly done now. Those are my two examples, Brad. What do you think?
Well, I think there's no question that the first you outlined, the idea that you have a plan with no core menu items but just brokerage, one or more brokerage windows, is one DOL has already had some pretty harsh words for. I mean, in both the initial guidance that was rescinded and in the later guidance, they the same has said that, you know, we think that may in fact be an imprudent plan design and a sort of a per se no-no. Now, obviously, when they said that, it didn't have the force of law, so to speak. It wasn't a regulation, but it indicated that they were taking a very dim view of that plan design, again, because they think it's avoiding the whole purpose of the duty of the fiduciary to provide some information to the participants with which to make decisions. So it's very clear that's one that they're not liking. I would suspect that
whatever else they do in this, we'll see something addressing that scenario, either, if not necessarily prohibiting it, certainly putting new requirements on it to address those concerns. I think the second example where, the ability of the participants to select their own broker, and it's an augment to sort of an otherwise, quote-unquote, normal plan, I think that's the reason DOL put out such an extensive RFI, is scenarios like that one, where they know there are a lot of different uses going on. Another example might be, when are these brokerage windows being used as actually, having investment, discretionary investment managers managing the funds for those participants as, the 338 fiduciaries. There are all sorts of scenarios that DOL knows it doesn't know enough about yet to really get in and regulate. And so if you look at the 39 or so questions that were in this RFI, they were very broad-based to get at all of these issues. And so I look at it that DOL is potentially considering some very broad regulation here, not just going after those sort of oddball plans that are all brokerage windows, but really looking at all of these issues. Other ones that come to mind are, how did you select what was available through the brokerage window? Are you letting participants invest in commodity futures, or is this limited to just a menu of a couple thousand ETFs, or what is it that's on the other side, and how did you select that, and what's the fiduciary obligation? I think there are actually some potential chances for there to be some useful fiduciary guidance coming out that might limit some liability, even as there might well be some other forms of this guidance that go against what people are commonly doing now and might be viewed as more restrictive. But at this point, I think it's a very broad-based effort to look at a lot of issues, and there's a lot of different things that could come out of it.
Yeah, even under the Internal Revenue Code, there are reasons for fiduciaries to be involved. For example, to prohibit the brokerage account from having margin accounts, because otherwise the plan would have to file income tax returns for debt-financed income, to prohibit the plan from, to prohibit the brokerage account from using investments that could generate unrelated business taxable income. For the same reason, the plan would have to file a income tax return and reach into the brokerage account and pull back money to pay the taxes. I haven't seen much attention focused on any of that. I suspect that's probably because the IRS must not be auditing those issues. But it's the nature of the government that today they can decide to audit what happened 2 years ago. And people will get shocked by that. Matter of fact, we're going to talk pretty shortly about an area where the rules changed after the fact and people got caught up in it.
Just to jump in real quick, one area that I think the DOL is kind of hinting around, but I think it'll be interesting to see how it develops in the responses, is, who's using the brokerage windows and what issues does that present? I mean, if, for example, it's mostly highly comped employees who are using the brokerage window and they therefore are not paying some of, say, the record-keeping expenses that are being charged through 12B1 fees or other fees to some of the core menu items, what issues come up where the highly comps are paying less of the expenses of running the plan? And are there equitable expense allocation issues? There's just a whole host of things the DOL could get into, depending on the responses they see coming out of this RFI.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to come back to you on a minute, Brad, and ask you what do you think people should be doing now, plan sponsors and advisors. But let me point out two other issues I'm somewhat concerned about in this area. The first is that 408B2 requires a list of specific disclosures by the broker-dealer to the responsible plan fiduciary. I'm pretty sure that in most cases where each partner or each participant can select their own brokerage provider, I'm pretty sure that those 408B2 disclosures are never getting to the responsible plan fiduciaries of the plan. And that means there's a privity transaction going on, and nobody knows about it, unless you say the participant as a responsible plan fiduciary. But looking in the documents and looking at the minutes of committee meetings and the like, there's nothing that delegates that fiduciary responsibility to the participant, and that raises the whole question of whether 100% of the participants are competent to be fiduciaries. So that's a 408B2 issue. I'm really worried that the disclosures are not as good as they should be, and that there are a lot of privity transactions out there just laying on the ground, just waiting to be found. And they'll be found the next time the market takes a big drop. The second thing I'm worried about are the participant disclosures. I'll just give you one example. But 404A5, the regulation, already requires three sets of disclosures to participants about brokerage accounts. But it's not just to the participants that have the brokerage accounts. It's to all of the participants, meaning those who have balances in the account. For example, people who've left but still have an account balance, as well as those that are still in, and those who are eligible to participate but who don't have an account balance. And not only does it have to be given out as a part of the original enrollment package, but it has to be given out every year thereafter, because that's how 4045 works. Okay, now imagine a plan that has 15 different brokerage accounts that different participants have selected. How do you get, and let's say there's 100 employees in the plan, how do you get those information from those 15 broker-dealers and distribute it to all 100 employees every year that satisfies the three disclosure requirements in the 4045 regulation? I think that's mind-boggling, but you know, and I think that's the right interpretation, but there's just no additional guidance other than participants have to get information every year, and there's very specifically what the information is, including information about fees inside the brokerage account every year. So it's just not clear, but it's another area that's got some potential for problems. And I think that whole area of brokerage accounts is a little bit unexplored, but it's going to get a lot more explored, as Brad suggested, through this RFI process. Brad, back to you now. What do you think advisors and plan sponsors should be doing about this with what we know today?
Well, I think I'm going to fall back on the ERISA lawyer's old standby, which is prudent process. You know, I think you need to have shown that you've at least thought about some of these issues. You know, you need to have a rationale for why you selected the brokerage window provider you did. Something in the record showing that you considered it and you went through a process to arrive at this conclusion, so that that's something you can justify if it's ever questioned. Similarly, I think if you have one of these oddball plan designs, I think you really need to think about that, because chances are it's clear from the 5500 you're filing that you don't have any core menu items. And if DOL is going to pick some folks to investigate, a plan they've had an expressed antipathy towards seems likely to be one that's going to draw some investigation. So you might want to think about, does it make sense to add a 404C compliant core menu to go with a plan design like that, which shouldn't really be that hard. I mean, let's remember 404C was written in the mid-90s, and so the requirements are essentially three investments that you diversify across the full spectrum and at least quarterly trading, and obviously there's some disclosure issues too. But, I think that's something to consider on some of those plan designs. But the biggest one is just start thinking about some of these fiduciary issues. You know, how did you decide what's on the other side of the window? How did you pick the provider? Having some of that documentation in there now is going to be helpful for you, regardless, I think, of where DOL comes out.
Yeah, I agree. And as one example of documentation I would have in the plan fiduciary's due diligence file would be documentation of what the services are that are offered by the broker-dealer and documentation of what the costs are. And guess where that's found? That's 408B2 disclosure. And so at the very least, as evidence that the fiduciaries had at least thought about it, I'd have the 408B2 disclosures in the plan's due diligence files. But I wouldn't just accept a really bland 408B2 disclosure that says we provide brokerage services and we charge commissions, period. And that's not what the rules contemplate, yet that's what I've seen delivered in some cases. So I think something along the lines of what Brad said, and certainly the 408B2 disclosures are a starting point. Okay, I think we've beaten that horse. Let me move on to fairly quickly cover the case of Fifth Third Bancorp versus Dudenhofer. That's the recent Supreme Court decision on company stock inside plans. And we'll move through this fairly quickly, because I know that not everybody on the call works with plans that have company stock in them. But historically, there was a thing called a Munch presumption, and that goes back to a case decided years ago that, yes, was called the Munch case. And it said that there was a presumption in favor of fiduciaries if they held company stock in the plan, that it was prudent to hold it. And that got reinforced by subsequent cases that said, particularly if there's a provision of the plan document that requires the fiduciaries to hold company stock in the plan. And so, as you might imagine, we went out and amended all the plans that didn't already say it to require it at that point. And that was a body of law. I mean, that was a pretty consistent body of law all across the country, and case after case over many years. Well, along came the Fifth Third Bancorp decision. And the Supreme Court said there is no Munch presumption. There is no presumption that it's okay to hold company stock in a plan, that it's prudent. And we don't, we've looked at ERISA, we don't find it anywhere in ERISA. It was just a court-created doctrine of many years ago that all the courts bought into. But it's not in the law. I'll tell you, I'd look for it. It's not there. And so in that sense, I think the Supreme Court were right. There is nothing in the law that says there's a presumption. Interestingly, the court went on to say, also, there is no presumption in favor of something that's hardwired into a plan document. Just because a plan document says something, it doesn't mean that it's prudent to follow it, that the fiduciaries have to make an independent decision of whether or not something is prudent, notwithstanding the provision in ERISA that says the fiduciaries are bound to follow the terms of the document because of a phrase that follows that. The following phrase is, unless it's imprudent to do so. And the Supreme Court focused on that unless language and said, hey, wait a second, there's still a duty to be prudent. You can't hardwire something in your document and get out of satisfying the prudence requirement, the fiduciary standard. Both of those were the earth moved under the feet of ERISA attorneys and plan sponsors of company stock. It was a material change. The effect of that was that it's going to be a lot easier to sue fiduciaries that have company stock in their plans. But, surprisingly, while it's easier to sue and to go through discovery and to make life miserable for them for years, surprisingly, the court went on to say two other things that make it easier for fiduciaries to win the cases, ultimately. So it's going to be harder to get out of the case along the way, but easier to win the case ultimately. They said, for example, the Supreme Court said they bought into the efficient market hypothesis, so the efficient market theory. They said that fiduciaries, absent special circumstances, have a right to rely, well, publicly traded stock, have a right to rely on the marketplace setting the right price based on all publicly available information. So the fiduciaries can look at the stock price and say, that reflects all the information that's out there. Absent special circumstances, we don't have to second-guess the stock market valuation and say, hey, it's really worth less. We have to sell it. That's not required. As a part of that same thing, they unfortunately didn't define special circumstances. We have no idea in the world what that means. And I've met with plan committees, and we've come up with some theoretical ideas of what a special circumstance can be, but none of them seem like very practical, like the odds of them actually happening are very high or significant at all. Nonetheless, that's where I think the plaintiff's attorneys will put their effort in the future, trying to find special circumstances where a plan committee should have known that the public markets, the securities markets, were not establishing the proper price for the stock. So that's one area where they gave great relief, just tremendous relief to fiduciaries. The other area is they said, furthermore, fiduciaries are not required to break the law. Obviously. I mean, that's a pretty obvious statement. But what they meant by that was that fiduciaries are not required to trade on inside information. So the first part of the holding dealt with public information. The second part dealt with inside information, which is that fiduciaries don't have to take their inside knowledge on information that is going to be released to the public and act on it first before the public has a chance to respond. So they don't have to act on inside information. They're protected from knowing something that isn't public yet, and still not selling the stock, even though it would be highly adverse. There's more to the case than that, but I don't want to take this totally into the weeds. Let me say that the Supreme Court did say, in saying that there's no Munch presumption, that fiduciary, in so many words, they said that fiduciaries have to monitor company stock like any other investment. So if you're working with plans that have company stock in it, the number one outcome is those committees now have to monitor it. They've got to be monitoring it like they monitor the mutual funds. So that's a big change, a huge change. It increases the burden, but not necessarily the liability. As a part of that, I'm working with plan committees to help them develop investment policy guidelines for company stock that are very similar to what I told you about what you can and cannot rely on or what you do and don't have to do. But it creates a whole process for committees to go through. And I think committees now need to have that. So not only do they have to monitor, I think they should also have a process, and I think it should be a documented process, much like the investment policy statements for other investments. Brad, I don't know if you want to add something to that, but that's sort of where I ended up.
No, I think that was a good overall summary and the important points. The only sort of nitpicky thing I would point out there is, you know, it wasn't universal that every court had adopted the presumption. That's why we ended up having it litigated, is not every circuit had adopted it. But it was a very common and fairly widely accepted view. It is worth noting that it's one DOL was always against, and so they've been doing a little happy dance that their amicus brief prevailed. But the other thing I'd point out is, you know, DOL has also always taken the view that if you have company stock as an option, that you need to treat it as other options and go through that full process. But I think probably the group that has the most to sort of worry about from this decision really are those who have closely held securities. And that's where they really need to pay a lot of attention to their fiduciary due diligence, even more so than some of the others.
Yeah, that's a hard group because there's not really a whole lot they can do if the company goes south, because there's no market to sell the stock into, even if they decide that's the best thing to do. That's a very difficult situation. Well, let's go from there, which is a subject of fairly of deep interest to a limited group of people. Let's go into target date funds, which everybody cares about. And the Department of Labor has issued proposed regulations on additional disclosures for target date funds under the QDIA regulation, the Qualified Default Investment Alternative regulation, and under the 404A5, the Participant Disclosure regulation. So they've got those two proposed regulations sitting out there. The SEC has issued proposed guidance primarily focusing on the advertising rules and what can and cannot, what should and should not be said about targeted funds and communications with investors and others. With that sort of a generic introduction, Brad, do you want to dive into it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the upshot of all this interest in TDF disclosure is that things keep dragging out and the regulations keep being delayed. The Department of Labor put out its proposed regulation back, I think, in 2010, if I remember correctly. And actually, they've been poised at least twice to issue a final rule. I think they were last scheduled to do so this March. But really, in deference to the SEC and to coordinate their activity, the department has sort of reopened their record on the department's regulation and not move forward without the SEC with them. I think it's important to just understand a couple of the material differences between what the two agencies are doing. They're obviously parallel related regulations, but they are doing different things. You know, the Department of Labor approach is to be not necessarily quite as deep, not getting down into the level of detail about all the issues the SEC is considering, but the DOL is looking beyond mutual funds. The DOL is looking at any sort of target date feature that's being applied to an investment, whether it's a mutual fund, whether it's a collective investment trust, whether it's a model portfolio, whatever it might be, and having that disclose certain information about, you know, when is this investment at its most conservative allocation, what's the significance of the target date, you know, those kinds of issues be disclosed a little more shallowly, but across a wider range of products, whereas the SEC is really focusing on mutual funds and getting down into quite a few weeds. And part of the reason all this has been delayed is that it's clear from all the work the SEC and other researchers have done that participants, despite the, you know, one of the benefits of TDFs being their simplicity in explanation, if not in actual operation, participants really don't understand what they are. You know, a large number of participants think they have guaranteed income in them. There's all these issues that the regulators are really trying to figure out how to make sure people understand. So the upshot is we're further away from seeing a final regulation on what needs to be disclosed for plans than we have been, you know, for another year or two. I mean, it just keeps getting moved along while the SEC works on its side of things.
Yeah, as you all might imagine, this came out of 2008 and how badly some near-term target date funds did. One lost over. One 2010 fund in 2008 lost over 40%, and that just shook up everybody, and they realized that the target date on a target date fund doesn't necessarily mean anything in terms of how it's invested. In other words, there's no common definition of what a 2010 target date fund is other than that it's designed for somebody who's going to retire that day. But they can be extremely different. And people didn't know that. I mean, participants in plans did not know that they could be really, really different one from another, 2010 funds. That now more or less be a 2015 fund, you know, in our time frame. And people were thinking that we're pretty secure. And so the idea here is to, by both the SEC and the DOL, is to provide information to people where they can assess the volatility of a particular target date fund. Now, query, can the average participant, even with all the information in the world, assess the volatility of a target date fund? The answer, of course, is no. But that's the direction we're going in. So as you look at these pieces of guidance, both at the SEC and the DOL, what they're focusing on is asset allocation at various stages. You start off with three stages, for example, what's the asset allocation of the target date fund today? What is it at the target of date, and what is it at the landing point, which is what Brad referred to as the most conservative point? And maybe you also illustrate that on a graph that has 5 or 10 year intervals on it. So the idea is to communicate asset allocation. I think that one practical effect of this is that they will be viewed as asset allocation vehicles going forward rather than as investments. And, you know, just, rather than just as a packaged investment. And so they'll be compared by plan fiduciaries based on asset allocation and what's appropriate for their plan and their participants. My advice to you all on the call, plan sponsors and advisors, is evaluate your target date funds on the basis of allocation, because that's where we're going now. And in particular, I would do a comparative analysis of asset allocation over the 10 years preceding the target date. So today that would be the 2015, 2020, and 2025 funds, and compare them to other target date funds in the marketplace so that you know, is the plan buying an aggressive fund, a conservative fund, and what's appropriate for that workforce. That's the analytical process that I see happening from here going forward. Asset allocation. Brad, shall I move on?
Yeah, I think so. The last thing I'll just say, because I think this can never too often be repeated, if you're a plan and you can't articulate why you have the target date fund you have, you don't have the process to back it up, you've got a problem. Even if you're using that as a QDIA, you only get the benefit of the QDIA safe harbor if you prudently selected the QDIA in the first place. So, I mean, you know, we've got the DOL guidance from last February, I guess February a year ago, whatever it was, that went through some of the factors to consider in making that determination. You really need the process behind this investment, as you would any other, to make sure that you're using it appropriately and getting the full benefit that the plan intends out of selecting a target date fund, for example, as a QDIA.
Yeah, and a part of that is looking at the demographics of the workforce, engaging in that kind of a process. Well, let's move on to rollovers, which I think everybody probably has an interest in, distributions and rollovers. A year and a half ago, the Government Accountability Office issued a report where they said participants aren't getting the information they need to make the four choices they have when they're eligible for a distribution. Those four choices are leave it in the plan, transfer to the plan of a new employer, take a taxable distribution, or roll over to an IRA. And the GAO said, furthermore, we think that some of the call centers of providers are sort of pushing, and not literally pushing, but have a bias in favor of their IRAs and their products, and that participants aren't getting the whole story. And that sort of started a second round, with the first round being 2005 when the DOL issued an advisory opinion. Well, they went for about 9 or 10 years with nothing happening. Now we're at the second round. And this one's bigger because it's because FINRA in December issued a regulatory notice, 13-45, that said that FINRA thinks that advisors have to do, if they're going to make a recommendation to take a distribution, they have to do a suitability analysis because a recommendation to take a distribution is necessarily also a recommendation for the participant to liquidate the investments in their 401k account. Therefore, it is a securities recommendation. To make things even worse, stories are starting to come out now about horrible, I don't know if they're horrible, but they sound horrible in the media, things that are happening. For example, there recently on Bloomberg, there was a story about how some broker-dealers were encouraging participants, soldiers, armed forces members to take their money out of the federal thrift plan and roll it over into IRA accounts with brokerages. But the expense ratios of the investments inside the federal thrift plan are range from about 0 to 10 basis points, or maybe a little bit more, but numbers that none of, at least I don't have access to personally. And when they take their money out of the plan, they lose access to those investments. When they roll it over, maybe they're investing in a mutual fund that provides, that has 100 basis points expense ratio. So they go from, let's say, 5 basis points to 100 basis points, and, you know, the prevailing thinking is that would hurt their return. Now, how can that be justified? Well, legally, I think it can be justified by saying, here's a really robust set of services that they're getting at the broker-dealer that they're not getting at the federal thrift plan, or that they're getting using an RIA at a broker, at an IRA, or that they're not getting. But that list of services has to equate or be equal to it, I would think, at the least, the loss of access to those federal thrift funds and the expenses. That's the kind of thing that's being considered. Then to top it off, the Department of Labor has indicated that when they issue their re-proposal of the fiduciary advice regulation, that they're going to deal with distributions and rollovers to IRAs as a part of that package. And that GAO report that I mentioned earlier is sort of, it would be a basis for the Department of Labor to say, to impose some significant regulation on the distribution process. Brad, let me end there. I have a couple other comments, but why don't you jump in and add whatever you want to that?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing, and Fred, you're right in describing it as sort of the second wave. This is the wave that everybody in Washington is getting on board with and is concerned about. And one of the main reasons for that is the amount of assets that are now in IRA accounts have probably exceeded the amount of assets in ERISA plans, which is a pretty big event. And that's got a lot of people in Washington concerned because they view the ERISA world as being very highly regulated and very much participant-centered, which they don't necessarily think is the case in the IRA marketplace. And so I think you're seeing FINRA's action coming as a way to start addressing those concerns. And I think DOL is likely to jump into this, as Fred said, because I think they're viewing it as, you know, part of their current position sort of is, I think in their view, is kind of abdicating some of the protections that they think they ought to provide. So, for example, if you are not currently a fiduciary to a plan, then DOL's under its current view has essentially said, well, it's not really an ERISA issue when someone cold calls a participant to do a rollover or when a service provider who's not a fiduciary, like a record keeper or some of that nature, solicits a rollover from a participant. That's not an ERISA fiduciary issue, and it's not one DOL is really historically regulating. And I think that's one of the issues that they've highlighted in their fiduciary regulation and are probably going to address, as Fred said, to try and, you know, get some jurisdiction over that, to assert some authority to try and prevent what they perceive to be some ills out there. The problem I think that creates, though, is, and we've talked about this before, if you're a fiduciary to the plan, DOL has said it may be a prohibited transaction for you to deal with rollovers. Well, that creates an odd situation where right now the current view is if you're unaffiliated with the plan, DOL doesn't have a concern, and so who knows what the quality of that exchange is. But if you are a fiduciary advisor to the plan who's been vetted by the plan fiduciary, who's been selected and gone through this process, and is a known entity, you know, you may not be able to deal with a rollover. And again, let's emphasize there are ways that folks have developed to let them receive rollovers when they're fiduciaries and that they are comfortable with, but it's a legal gray area that they're operating in. So DOL has, I think, a bit of a conundrum on its hands, which is how do they expand access, jurisdiction rather, how do they expand jurisdiction with the goal of protecting participants from their perspective, but do so in a way that's not actually making it harder for participants to get advice about what to do with rollovers when they come up. And that's really the tension that's out there. And I think, you know, across the board, whether it's FINRA or the SEC examination priority on these issues, whether it's DOL's likelihood to get into, you know, this in a regulation, we're seeing a lot of agencies being very concerned about what's going on with the rollovers in this lifetime accumulation of savings and plans.
Now, we're going to wrap it up here and go to Q&As in 1 second, but just to add a final thought, we'll cover the other subjects on our next call. We always have too many because we're fearful of running out of time, giving the whole presentation and still having time left. But a final thought on IRAs, I think that advisors, broker-dealers and RIA firms need to explore how they're going to run IRAs with low-cost investments. I think the focus is going to be a lot on the cost of the investments inside IRAs from a policy perspective, and to the extent that they are significantly more expensive than what somebody could get in a plan, then it's got to be a real justification. What kind of a justification? Well, I think that advisors need to say, I'm going to specialize in IRAs. Literally, I'm going to specialize in IRAs. What is a robust list of 5 or 10 or 15 services that I can provide to IRAs that is going to demonstrate that my value is so much greater than any difference in the expense ratio between the investments and the other costs in the IRA, and the expense ratios of the investments in the plan? And so those have to be services in a greater than what people could get in the plan. So I really think it's going to require advisors to rethink what they're doing and to actually view IRAs not as investment pools, individual investment pools, but instead as individual retirement vehicles that for the other services are as important as the investment services. For example, withdrawal rates, minimum required distributions, tax planning for what's in the IRA and what's personal, on and on and on. That's where I think we're going. Okay. Operator, we've got a little bit of time for questions, and we're willing to run over a few minutes. Why don't you open it up now?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press *1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions.
Well, while we're waiting, Fred, let me just say that I certainly agree with what you just said, that part of the whole issue that folks in the IRA space are going to have to do is try and really articulate the additional value to explain the fee differentials. But what I think we would all benefit from is clearing out some of the legal underbrush here, having a prohibited transaction class exemption that says, here are the conditions for how you do a rollover in the retirement space, which would enable us to not have some of these artificial distinctions between providers and could do a lot to put in place a framework that would address concerns on both sides of the ledger in making sure participants have access to advice that's quality and that's good.
I agree, and it should be clear-cut and probably disclosure-based.
That said, I'm not terribly optimistic. That's what we'll see in the fiduciary regulation deal. Well, it puts out scheduled to put out in January. But we'll see. Maybe I'll be surprised.
Operator, anybody?
Yes, we'll take our first question. Caller, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Fred and Brad. This is Jim Sotel. I had a question just related to that last topic, and our firm's a pure RIA with no broker-dealer affiliation. However, as you all know, there's a lot of entities that are duly licensed, and under that umbrella, they're acting as a fiduciary on the plan, but either they or their broker-dealer are interested in the IRA rollover. So I'm curious as to the undercurrent or the issues that are going to create when the advisor is wearing the hat as the plan fiduciary and then meeting with participants for one-on-one educational meetings and then cross-selling products, either IRA rollover or individual products, and then acting as a broker?
Yeah, first off, just for background, I think there's 4 different groups of people that are going to be affected by this. There's RIAs who are providing services to plans and in the role that you talked about, your situation. The second, I think, is the registered representatives of broker-dealers who man call centers for the providers. The third is non-fiduciary financial advisors of broker-dealers who provide services to plans. And then the fourth is just the retail broker-dealer who just happens to capture rollovers but doesn't provide plan services, and each one is its own category. So going back to your category, a couple of thoughts. I think you need a carefully designed program if you're serving as a fiduciary to a plan because of DOL Advisory Opinion 2005-23A. That's the one Brad and I have been referring to. You need to have a carefully designed program with a good set of disclosures and acknowledgments that helps you get the rollovers. And you need to be very careful about not making recommendations but simply providing services. So that's for rollovers. For outside assets, for individual assets owned by the participants but they aren't in the plan, interestingly, there is no DOL regulation of that. I worry a little bit about an endorsement effect. So I tell plan sponsors that if advisors are going to be selling products to their participants and also providing services through the plan, to make sure they have a clear understanding with the advisor of what's going to be done, because I worry that could be viewed as the employer endorsing the advisor for that purpose, and that they have to make sure that there's really robust disclosures about costs and fees to the participants. But that's not required. That's just me worrying about that endorsement effect. In terms of what I know about the law, and I'm not a securities lawyer by any means, but the only rules I can think would be the insurance laws for insurance products and the securities laws for securities products would govern that sales process. Brad, I don't know, you want to add anything to that?
Well, yeah, DOL has always been uncomfortable with cross-selling because there's a question, I think, in their minds as to whether that can cross the line and become a prohibited transaction, but they haven't put out what I would call any real definitive guidance or statements to that effect. It's just sort of a thing that they worry about, that you're using your position as a fiduciary to get it close to this plan in order to then sell them other personal wealth management services or whatever they might be, and that could be a prohibited transaction, but it's not something they've really staked out a clear position on. Even to the extent, as we were just discussing with the advisory opinion Fred mentioned, even where it is a more clear case of you're soliciting a rollover, which is going to result in a fee differential in most cases, even there they've only said it may be a prohibited transaction. So it's a legal gray area that, as I said before, it'd be better if we could have it cleared up. But be aware that it's a gray area and do the kinds of disclosures Fred's talking about as part of your analysis of whether you want to get into those other lines of business.
Operator, is there another question?
Yes, we'll take our next question. Caller, go ahead.
Yes, hi. This is Don Strobe. I have a question. If there's concerns about rollovers coming out of plan, is there any thought to relaxing some of the standards on providing or providers providing advice to participants in the plan? Have you seen any relaxation or movement in that area?
Brad?
No, we haven't. And you know, you're going to get me up on my soapbox because these are the two biggest areas where I think we're letting the prohibited transaction rules make the perfect the enemy of the good. You know, it's difficult to get advice to participants from most of the service providers to plans because of a conflict of some sort that gives rise to a prohibited transaction. It's a similar issue when you're looking at the rollover question that DOL has presented us with. And that's why I was saying I think we really need a clear-cut path for how to do a rollover and a better path for how to give advice. But we haven't seen any real change. The advice situation is still where it is, where you can use sort of an outside advisor a la SunAmerica. You could use an outside advisor a la the Pension Protection Act process, although, frankly, I think it's less likely you'd see a computer model through the Pension Protection Act than you would through SunAmerica. You have level fee ways, several different ways you can achieve that. So it's an area where if you want to get into advice to participants, you really need to make sure you've dotted your I's and crossed your T's.
Okay, thank you.
Operator?
Yes, we'll take our final question. Caller, go ahead.
Thank you. This will be the last question. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Joyce Fraley, and my question is, could you confirm that I heard you correctly with respect to the self-directed brokerage account disclosure? Does that not only need to be disclosed and reviewed ongoing by the plan sponsor as part of the 408B2, but also then provided to the employees, eligible employees, as part of the 404A5 disclosure?
Those two disclosures are similar but not identical. So focusing just on the 404A5 disclosure, and there's a question and answer in Field Assistance Bulletin 2012-02R that lays out the three sets of disclosures that have to be provided to participants. But, yes, if that's a feature of the plan, if that's something the plan is offering to its participants, then it has to provide that kind of information to participants about the availability of the brokerage accounts, about how they can set it up, about what the services and fees are, and so on. The DOL guidance, by the way, it's really much more consistent with where one broker-dealer is selected and it's provided to, the information is provided to the participants. It's very inconsistent with the other arrangements, which suggests that the DOL didn't know about them when it initially wrote that rule or didn't think they were significant.
Right. And then the same would be true for the 408B2 disclosure as well, that really should be included as part of the plan sponsor disclosure or an addendum to it.
Well, the 408B2 disclosure, you know, the language in there says it has to be disclosed to the responsible plan fiduciary. And the responsible plan fiduciary for selecting and monitoring service providers is, just as a general rule, the ERISA plan administrator, sometimes called the 316 fiduciary. And it's that person who should be receiving, even though the regulation calls it the responsible plan fiduciary, meaning the fiduciary responsible for that particular activity. Even though that's the person that the broker-dealer should be providing the disclosure to. Now, I will tell you, I helped a lot of broker-dealers with this issue back in 2012 because we had that July 1 deadline for getting everything out in 2012. And the truth is, I think most of them just made the best effort they could to get the disclosure out to anybody. But my advice back then was, and continues to be today, that going forward, as a part of these account openings, you need to be getting finding out who the responsible plan fiduciaries are so that the disclosures can be provided to them in the future. I mean, 2012, it, under the surface, was a bit of a disaster, but now it's time to get everything sort of organized and do it right. It's just the records weren't there to accomplish what the Department of Labor wanted. That was why it was a disaster. It wasn't, I mean, people made a really good faith effort to comply. But at some level, it was very difficult.
Great.
Anyway,
thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Well, Jim, I think we've reached the end of the road here. Do you want to say goodbye and let people know what the next date is?
Certainly, Fred. And I did want to thank everyone for joining us on the call today. We certainly do appreciate your participation. Fred and Brad, thank you again for doing this call. We're grateful for the partnership. I'd like to let everyone know that on December 4th, we will have our next call. As Fred mentioned earlier, there will be an email that will let you know when the recording is available for this call. So again, thanks so much for joining us. And Noah, you can close us out if you'd like.
Thank you. And this does conclude today's conference. Thank you very much for your participation.